RIS. We can set it up so that you can use it on three basic simple formats, Apple, IBM, or say a TRS-80. Okay, so there's basic ways. So I want to put that stuff on the disk so that people with those things can use them. And they can not have to go visually through a catalog, which we can supply as well, which is just a simple print off.
Obviously, waiting through 500 hours to get to hour 499.
Yes. Yes. So it's instead of providing you a book of all this, at your option, you can have the stuff on the disk itself, and then dump it down to your unit at home. Okay.
What are we talking about in terms of cost
for a? All right. The machine physically is, as I said, you know, $9,600, $1,300 for the controller, $150 for the disk, and now you have to put the stuff in. So you have to have a camera, okay? If you have a video camera around for your stills, for your analog, you're feeding in audio, plug it in, and run it. Pardon?
Plug out into an
Who is this? It's in the box. It showed you on the Thompson system that the components are controlled in the controller. The components are in the controller.
The conversion is done in the
controller.
A to D to A.
D to A, yeah.
And does this require any special training to do?
No, I can do it. You can do it.
You have special
training. Nah, it's a box.
Sure.
Yeah.
So you're talking basically for
okay.
I didn't say that disparagingly.
Please. I didn't say that disparagingly.
If I read you correctly, then you're saying that for under $12,000,
yes,
you can put 500 hours of audio onto a disc.
Well,
and retrieve it,
you can't, okay. You can't, because you can't buy the box. They're all sold out. They made 1,000
this week.
And they made 1,000 models, and they said, we're going up with 1,000 to try to find out how this thing goes, and everybody bought them up. Now, the next availability is somewhere in November, December.
Fine.
Okay.
I'm saving my money now. but the next important point is that for the next 500 hours, it's only costing you $125.
$150.
Excuse me, maybe I can get a discount.
All right, but it's going to cost you, it's going to cost you a lot more people time, you see.
People time in what respect? For input?
People.
Yes.
Yeah, that's where the price is nowadays. You can buy the hardware and take it home. You can do a lot of, you know.
Assuming that you're running some kind of automatic dubbing setup, a setup that you prepared your tapes beforehand to be fed into the machine or whatever preservation system you would be using, you have the tape leadered and timed and cataloged and so forth. That you would do regardless of what your eventual storage medium would be. So it's only the input time, which from what you say could be done by minimum wage labor provided it stays awake.
There's little tricks that you can do, which is you don't go in at normal time. You can go in at double, triple, quadruple, the time type thing. Instead of playing it back at 3 3/4, you play it back in 7 1/2.
What does that do to equalization?
When it comes back out, you got to change it around.
So you have to have the...
So it's going to feed to you double speed, okay?
Yeah.
And then you have to change your speed of the recorder back again.
That's very interesting.
Yeah.
You mentioned the trade-off between playing time and...
Yes.
Bandwidth and dynamic range.
Yeah.
It's
that's the only way it works. Yeah.
At what point do you know at which point the trade-off becomes unacceptable in terms of...
I can't give quality. I'm technical, and it's not my position to judge who is what. You know what I mean?
Does the machine come with specifications that says if you put 500 hours of the machine, you get a frequency response of X to...
Those are not available yet from the engineers, but I'm told they are coming very shortly.
We don't know at which point this machine...
I've been bugging them to try to get all the tech specs out of them. And... Oh, well, let's look at it. Look at it. At 2,300 hours of linear predictive coding is going to sound like Mr. Bell.
Right. What would 500 sound like?
Then that you see everything's proportional. I can do it mathematically. You know, let's get a massive board and try to calculate it. But
because it seems to me that you could put, for example, even with present home laser discs or CDs, that you could put 78s on, which have a limited frequency response, so say 10 or 12,000 cycles, and not run into the problems that you're having with sampling rate at the high frequencies.
Yeah.
With ultra high fidelity.
Yeah. That little 2-hour disc that's that you sell, that you can buy, is probably about 8 or 10 hours on that thing that you can put on that size. But they do it in 2 hours because they have all the cross coding and everything else on it.
Correct.
They record it 4 times. Pardon?
You're dealing with 2 channels.
Yes. Yes, and yeah,
but
yeah.
Because they've dropped the quantization on that to give you to be able to sell it to you.
Yeah.
From the kind of standards that Fred's talking about, that's the trade-off.
Yeah. 16 bits as opposed to 14.
That's right. Yeah.
What is the archival life of this capacity disk?
One guy came out, RCA, no, it was 3M, and we were having meetings with different people, and they came, and the guy said, well, Arts, I'm sure this thing is 100 years plus. And I said, what is that? Give us the right to go and dig up your grave and throw your bones around if it's not true. So let's take life cycle testing in the lab, and what they've done is 50 years plus, okay? Now, I've heard all kinds of stuff that people are talking about.
Yeah,
yeah. But there's some really bad words going around. One group of people are saying, oh, you can only get 5 years, you see, because there's all kinds of oxidation that takes place inside, and that will over a period of 5 years. That thing's been solved a long time ago. These companies have invested. I'll give you an example. Mashushta, okay? That's the firm, I used to call it Meshashita as well, until I met their director, and he said, Mashushta.
Oh, I'm glad to know that.
An example of their costing is, this is 1982 research and development, $581 million. They've got 21 research facilities, and they're not small. 14,000 products they sell, and 145,000 employees. They invest that kind of money in new technology. These people, by fact, own Panasonic, Techniques, Quasar, and National. Okay. When they invest $581 million on new digital technology coming out of their different systems, they're not interested in trying to say, well, we won't be around very long. You know, the products are good, they're well-tested, they're very competent internationally, and when you say something like, well, this thing is going to fall apart in no time at all, that's not true.
Well, who is it who says that anyway?
People well, the competitor.
The last time you looked at color photographs, Kodak printed on paper for you, and Kodak has been around
while. What I'm referring to is, did you see the Kodak spec that gave you life cycle tests?
Yes.
Yes? And did you believe that?
No.
In this regard, what we're talking about is computer coding and not something physically degradable.
No, the only thing I'm questioning is your logic that the
no.
Around so
yes. No, I'm not, yes, I agree with you on that particular reference.
Well, they've got products to sell. They can sell you television sets.
What does Kodak sell to you? When was the last time you didn't buy Kodak?
Kodak, well, you want to buy, there's all kinds of companies.
When Fuji came along. When Kodak, yes.
Is there anything else? The fact is, no, the only reference that I have in longevity and belief is that people are very skeptical. You're not going to jump over to a system that's going to fall apart in 5 years. That's absolutely garbage. Well, what we can do is, you have an alternative, you know, what we can do is just sit around for 50 years and wait before we do anything, right?
Amen. I'd like that.
Sure.
Then you can say, I'm telling you something.
Yeah.
The Thomson system, which presumably is not compatible with these others, is that correct?
Right now, the draw systems are not compatible. The optical systems that I showed you, the other ones are compatible. But the Thomson and Panasonic draw systems are as yet not compatible.
How, all right, on the Thomson, what is the estimated longevity there? Or is that equally...
I don't have the tech specs on the individual companies, okay? But if you wanted those, you can just contact the people. They have American reps in Thomson as well. And just contact your... You're not talking a lot of bucks, you know? if I wanted to buy an Ampex open reel transport, one tape recorder, it's the same price. Yeah.
All right.
Is there anything? That's it?
No, I'm sorry. My apologies.
I certainly, that's a good idea. No. Because they're going optical, you see? It doesn't mean RCA are not going to be in the business. Instead of capacitive, they're going optical. And people in the industry have known that for a long time.
Okay.
Jerry, you're serious about that? They have announced that they are really going to be dropping? That's funny, because in the recent last year or two, their sales have been better in the consumer market. Even though we know the technology is not as good as the laser system.
You can't buy the laser vision players today. There's a tremendous shortage of the good players. They have Sylvania, the Magnavox, and the Pioneer. They're not available. The industrial companies have been buying them up. The Japanese factory closed one factory just to concentrate on these players. They're trying to get them into the arcade. The arcade games, the only ones that are going are the laser vision ones, and they don't have the players for.
Well, yes, you can't do the arcade games very well on the capacitance disc. You don't have enough control over the stylus that it's going to stay in the same groove when you need it to, or whether it's going to go to the right groove. And so. So that's true. The one thing which bothers me, when you mentioned while showing the slides about the laser discs, is that the label is on the opposite side of the information. As a discographer, that bothers me. You know, years from now, the numbers are not going to match. Well, because they don't have scribe matrix numbers anyway. That's a good question, though. What do they do in the factory? You know, they know they get the label on the right side, the correct side. You used to be able to look at the matrix numbers printed on the labels. We're assuming that the people in the factories are better, or they're all automated now, anyway. The reason why I'm doing small talk, we have time, that's the point.
What about the matrix numbers on something with 6,000 cuts?
Well, you know, when we had a talk, one of the Sony representatives and a few other representatives were at the IAZA conference giving us a talk sort of like this, although it went even further. And what he said at the end was, we've got this great system, and what you should do is transfer all of your entire archives onto our system, not thinking at all about the fact that you've got to play the records first and play them correctly in order to transfer them. And meanwhile, we have been sitting here and we have been sitting there and arguing, and we've been doing it here, as to the proper way to play the records in the first place. If you do your transfers wrong onto the video disc, you will now have a permanent reproduction of an improper transfer. And that's the one thing which the people who are devising these systems don't understand. To them, when you play a phonograph record, you put it on the changer, hit the reject switch, and that's all you need to do. The arm will lower itself into the groove. That's their concept of playing a record. That's automation, that's right. They would never think of using a manual turntable. Yes?
I might mention something for the knowledge of the people here. Even on laser vision, there's some phony stuff going on there. MGM in particular is at fault. You may be heard about it. To get a film on one disc, like an American in Paris, I believe.
And that's entertainment.
What they've done is they speeded it up to get it on. Let's say 125 minutes was reduced to 120 minutes, but in the process, you're out of pitch on the whole disc.
Well, no, you're not out of pitch. What they are doing is using a... No, we have time, Jerry. Okay, but what they are doing is they can reduce the pitch digitally as well, but what is happening, you're speeding up the action, and Gene Kelly is doing a real fast jig instead of a very slow soft shoe. But as a matter of fact, the one thing I was going to mention, sometimes television stations are now playing video discs. When our local independent station in West Virginia a few months ago played That's Entertainment, they played it, I'm sure, off of the video disc, because when I made my home video tape of it, it cut out the commercials, it fit on the tape. I thought I was going to be 10 minutes short of tape. And so nothing was cut out. I looked at the running list. And the only way it could possibly be is that they speeded it up, and I haven't checked it against the MGM audio disc of it yet to see if that's what they did.
But there's another problem, too, and I found that on another disc. They said they're going to withdraw it. They released for the first time on LaserVision a Laurel and Hardy comedy, Flying Deuces. But if you watch that film, it's from a bad print. It's full of cuts, a lot of noise, and so on. And what they should have done, and I'm afraid this may happen, too, if you've got good records, they should put the best record on the archive or on the disc, because if they're using a bad print, that's going to be perpetuated into eternity. They can find the best print they can.
That's right. Art Schifrin has for years been trying to convince United Artists to use a good tape transfer from his set of the discs of the Jazz Singer instead of using that optical track that was made in 1932. They don't care. They really don't.
But probably
from the 35 millimeter to the 16 millimeter and taken off of there. Yes?
Just to follow up on what was said about MGM and UA, I've just been involved with a large set of discussions with their technical people about their VHS tapes and their video discs. They apparently, when they first started issuing stuff, they issued things very quickly, and they did not take a great deal of care with the quality of what they were doing. A lot of their films have been put out with improper color balance. Some things, there's no match between the audio and the visual dubbing. So you have things that are out of sync. They've done some indiscriminate cutting of material for time. And they're not particularly concerned about any of that. They're waiting for higher technology to come in before they'll do anything with the material that's already been issued.
Mm. And in a sense, also, you have to remember that when we're dealing with widescreen films, we are always losing, and in some cases when you go back to original CinemaScope, 2.5 to 1, and we're now 3 by 4 on television, you're losing literally half the picture. And so it will have to wait. You know, we cannot consider that what we are now getting on the market in our video discs can be the preservation copy of these films. It just cannot be. I did say something in my column in the journal a couple of years ago, doing a review of the Library of Congress, the Quarterly Journal of the Library of Congress article about preservation of film. That is an area that is more complicated than us. If we think we have problems with picking stylus sizes and speeds of playing back the discs, plus alternate takes, when you are dealing with a medium which is on a strip and frames can be cut and recut, interchanged, alternate takes of one scene versus another. In silent films, they may have two or three takes of every scene. When the negative wears out for one, they just pull one of the alternate scenes out of the vault. You may have dozens of different versions of the film on the market. That's more problems than we have with audio. And the film scholarship, unfortunately, is not as good as some of our record scholarship of the people here.
Mike, the problem starts with first-run films today. Hollywood is using two different aspect ratios. And most theaters don't care. They're showing everything in whatever they...
Yeah, 1.75 to 1 or 1.85 to 1. Yeah. And maybe it's being filmed at 2.1 to 1.
First-run films today are being shown without regard to the aspect ratio. What can you expect on archival?
Yeah, well, except, of course, when you're dealing with the local theaters, you have people that really do not know what they're doing.
Just to make a point that we're talking about copies in all cases here. We're not talking about what the original negative and its soundtrack is actually like. We're talking in all cases about copies. What Steve is talking about is taking a copy and making a preservation copy. And that's what Jerry's talking about, too. So we shouldn't get too confused about the derivative and messed up copies that we all are able to buy.
Yes, but you are assuming that the original negative or their blue copy, their preservation copy, their fine grains, are going to exist. Just like we assumed that RCA and Columbia were keeping all of their stuff in their vaults. We end up with the record companies coming to us for copies. You think maybe one of these days MGM is going to come to someone and ask for a LaserVision copy of the film so that they can put it out 20 years from now? It could happen. I wouldn't put it past them.
On Monday, we'll see that the interest of the big money people and film companies and film libraries for subsidiary exploitation has produced more awareness of the value of preserving these materials. If a film library, a Disney library, or a UA library, or UA libraries on the Warner
bringing
library,
in money,
MGM library is worth perhaps $700 million, then there's going to be more caretaking for the way these original materials are preserved.
That, of course, is only if we go out and buy things instead of bootlegging them. Jerry Gibbs.
On the preservation problem with film, as you say, is rather extensive. Unless I'm particularly interested in the topic here today on laser discs, and unless we're talking about moving image preservation and color, and whether you've got the original and the problems of titrating, we can go on for 6 weeks. I would like to ask if we get back to that topic. Sure, do you mind?
The reason why we have time is we're waiting for Bill Shirk to get back from the airport before we can go over to the Bowling Green Library. That's in case you're wondering how come suddenly we have time. Yes, Mike?
It seems to me that if nothing else, the space program proved that you can, the video information is infinitely easy to store because it is in fact discrete pixels on strings, each of which can be manipulated depending on the density of your scan. So preserving this visual information is probably easier, even in color.
I can't hear you.
Even in color than it is to preserve audio information, which is in fact continuous.
The problem with color material, right, part of my job at the library includes film preservation as well, unfortunately.
They changed the name of the division. He now has pictures to worry about, too.
Part of the problem with color is whose interpretation of what was intended to be the release cover are you going to be?
You can't do that.
That's right. The color timer making the prints and things like that can change from one release print to another. Yeah.
Again, we're talking about if the library has a copyright deposit copy, which is on a medium that has deteriorated, you have a job of preserving your copy. If the film company has a job of preserving its copy and its derivative copies. And it's impossible to know without seeing an original for what you got on.
Presumably, one of the few places in the country you can go to find an original theater release print, which according to the standards and the stipulations of the copyright law,
the best of it.
Yeah, it's one of the best is an unplayed theater projection print. And our copy is faded all to hell and back come Sunday.
But everyone else is too.
Right. Then you've got to go back to the studio master if it exists. And in many cases, this studio master, if you're talking titrate era, is also at the Library of Congress. And you go back to it, and whose interpretation of what that release print should look like? The 16mm version?
Yeah.
Have you ever seen or read a review of the original Gone with the Wind?
Yeah.
Did anyone see it recently on television?
I taped it.
Color development in Gone with the Wind, as well as the plot and music and everything else, was magnificent. But if you look at today, the color development of Gone with the Wind is practically
gone with the wind. Joe, if I remember correctly, when they did the re-release of it in 1967, because I was working for the company that was doing the advertising for them in 67 or 68, the jerks at MGM decided it was going to become a CinemaScope film, and so they cut the top and the bottom of Clark Gable's head off. Then they ended up not having any of the original 3x4 35mm left. Which means if you were to put it back on television, you'd now have to cut the sides of that print. But one print was found. So I think what we're having on television now is the remainder of the one print that MGM decided not to destroy.
That one print was not faded in one chance in 10,000.
But the problem you have is the company that owns that has got a problem. And the people who own derivative prints from that have a problem. And CBS has a problem because they pay $37 million for the rights to go on with a run on TV. If they've got something that looks like hell, they ought to go back.
Yeah, well, it didn't look that bad. There was a thing on, I'm possibly compared to the original, it probably did, and you don't have the A-B test there. There was a point that all of the prints of the Bonanza TV series, it's not in the same caliber of Gone with the Wind, but it's a good example. The preservation prints that the producers had held on to all faded, and when you see what they have left, there is just a very pale pastel blue and a little bit of a purplish color, which is supposed to be the red and yellow components, and electronically, they have brought it back to the original. But once again, we now... Okay. We can do the same thing that we do with audio, and that is let the viewer decide. If we can have, if we're projecting an emulsion film, a color temperature change on the lamp, that would change your color values. And we have the tint controls on our NTSC system. You'll never twice the same color is what NTSC stands for. When I was in Europe this summer, I was amazed to find that they didn't have tint controls on the television sets there, and they did not need the tint controls. And I understand on the CCAM system, they don't even have the color level controls on the set, because everything not only is automatic, it's correct, but we have the tint controls, and so if we don't like it, we can change it.
Audio.
We are the recorded sound collections or association.
For Fred. I thought you'd gotten away with it. Can you dub an optical disc to a second optical disc?
Yes.
And add information in the process?
Yeah. And edit it. What you're doing is taking the output from one machine. It's all in digital, and you're just pumping it into the next machine and making a copy.
But you're now going to remastering again, and your costs all over again.
Yeah, but is the color quality the same on the second one? I don't know.
We're talking audio.
Well, it's digital.
Well, sound, color, timbre, you know.
Yes, you may.
Mike?
Okay. The philosophical issue that Jerry brings up and concerns us all is, what is the original?
Yeah.
What is it? What is this thing? And it's not an issue that can be pinpointed, as it can't be in photography and it can't be in other ways. I simply would tell everyone a story that I told some people. I too was in Europe, but in January, and I visited Decca Records. And Decca, among other companies, is running a great many of its old tapes on the digital. They are committed to that technology. But I must say, I was appalled when I discovered that one of the tapes they were doing, in fact, I know the producer and he did it the next day, was a very famous mono recording of Das Lied von der Erde with Ferrier and Walter. Unfortunately, when they ran it on to the digital, they decided to re-equalize it. Not only did they decide to re-equalize it, they decided to add some echo, because they figured the judgment of the producer of this day, the original tape was not sufficiently good. Simply to point out that from now on, any derivative tape will be derived from the digital copy, which in turn has been equalized. With a taste of this person at this particular time.
Not all copies are going to be equalized.
In any respect, even if the companies involved who have the original material, which is ipso facto priceless, they are simply in the business of making copies, and the copies that they want to sell are the ones that will sell the most. And so they turn around and they as MGM did, they mask out the top and the bottom, because they figure people won't buy tickets to see something in the aspect ratio of the original issue. None of us are going to solve this problem. We're all going to be groping towards some kind of solution, but the equipment now is getting to the point where we can preserve any kind of decision we make and hope that it will be preserved in exactly the way we decided forever. So we're going to have to live with these things, not just the companies.
Mm-hmm.
We're all going to have to live with these decisions.
Yeah, I think...
Not have to find out that we made the wrong one.
As far as Tom's comment, the reason why, I'm just interpreting what Mike said, the reason why all derivative copies from now on will be from that digital master will be because everybody assumes that when they made that digital master from the original analog, they left their grubby paws off the equalization and echo chamber controls. That's the point. We are assuming it. They don't put on the liner notes of the record that we have fiddled around with the equalization and added an echo chamber because we think you're too dumb to know otherwise. They're not honest enough to tell us that they fooled around with it. And now, what happened back in 1958 when we started with stereo records, it was a big selling point. This record is stereo. And so a few years later when they started with electronic stereo, they would, put stereo or electronic or electronically remastered and things like that. Well, when they just put stereo on it and the Federal Trade Commission and others got on their tails about mislabeling of things, they decided, well, now everybody expects all records to be stereo, and so they don't put whether it is stereo or mono or remastered, because at that point, if they don't say anything, they're not lying. They're just not telling you what it is. You have to play it and guess. And, you know, we always have these kind of problems. Fred's carrying around the record that he, Fred Williams, you know, just put out, and, you know, it's a, you know, the military band acousticals. It is in mono. The album cover says stereo. So we run. Should we complain that it's not in stereo? There it is in the upper left-hand corner.
But it's been digitally remastered.
Yeah, that's the other problem. Sometimes they put, you know, digital, and what it means in some cases, depending upon the record company, might just be that they ran the audio, the analog, into a digital master. It really is a, you know, a digital remastered from an analog original, but not all the companies are saying that.
Fingers to prepare it.
That could be too.
The electrically recorded Paramounts where the light bulb in the studio is the only thing to collect.
That's right, yes. No, well, the light ray recording was legitimate. That was true. No, he's talking about something else. No.
Michael, have you heard many digital discs that were prepared from an analog source where you could A-B them with the analog source?
No, I have not had a chance to, and that's one of the things that I would like, that maybe in the next year, that would be one of the sessions we could do.
The Audio Engineering Society did that at a local chapter meeting. Most people prefer the analog tape.
It did, because I had one chance to do it, and I thought the analog was.
But they brought in $12,000 Studer machines, and they brought in the best of everything, speakers and everything. And most people prefer
technical information on the liner notes. The only records they used to give us technical information were the Miller International Stereo Fidelity records. You know. They would have that color spectrum on the side with the frequency response and everything, and got to the point in the early 60s we used to think that any record company that would put all this technical information on the label is trying to hide how lousy it is and trying to brag about that they're using Ampex 300-2s. You know, that looks, you know, good to people that don't know that the 300 was a 1952 machine. And things like that, and using AKG microphones, you know, or Altec mics or whatever. I think what is happening is the difference between analog and digital is going to start to be the fight we had in the 1960s, the difference between transistors and tubes, which of course is still a problem, because now with amp... What was that?
The battle's over in the business.
But tubes have won as far as we're concerned, but the business, transistors won. They'll come back to tubes, I'm sure of it. Steve?
As far as this is an aside, if we're killing a little time, that the tube business now that RCA has sold its tube manufacturing plant and dismantled it, there are now retired people in Florida to whom you send your tubes. They open them up, replace the filaments, pump out the air, seal them back up, and send them back to you. And it's now a retirement business. And that's the only way that you can get tubes in this country.
They did that back in the 1920s. In the next journal, there's going to be a review about a tube history book. That's one of the things he talks about in the last chapter of that particular book, rebuilding tubes for if you have a burned out filament. He can't do other things, but it's the filament replacements that they do on those. Yeah.
Explain a little bit about that Philco. Would that Philco beam of light? I don't know
what to talk about. Oh, no, what Mike was just mentioning was the light ray recordings, which was what Brunswick was doing. It's the palatrope and the palophotophone, which was a light ray microphone. It was just like a cone with a little mirror at the end of it and a light shining on it and an electric eye. That was the microphone. It was cut with a regular magnetic recorder. Charles Hoxie of GE was the inventor of that system. And they did that because Western Electric wouldn't license it to Brunswick for a couple of years.
The bad reputation that sound has is in great part undeserved.
I felt that too.
Those records play with a 2 mil stylus. They were simultaneously issued as longer playing records, those Brunswicks.
Uh-huh.
And the American made Brunswicks. And if you play them with a 2 mil stylus, they sound a heck of a lot better.
So in other words, we've been playing the shoulders of the grooves all these years.
Exactly.
Now,
back to audio just for a moment and the concept of preservation. Perhaps if we think in terms of Mike's remark of having to grope with this and the remark we had about the time that it takes to put material down into, to play it in, the choice of what copy we're going to use, we're faced with a problem that leads, I would submit, to the necessity for getting much, much more access to what's available so we know which copies to choose, and that one library isn't sitting there putting all of their collection of third-rate copies onto a preservation system and, you know, spending the thousands of hours that are involved when another archive has got better copies of the same material to do the same thousands and thousands of hours over. So we are really forced, if we're going to obtain the maximum from that technology, it seems to me, to know more and more about what is out there and available.
This is something that we discussed in the exec board meeting on yesterday afternoon, and I think that it probably will come up again a little bit in tomorrow afternoon session on the fair use as to how can we legally cooperate. And part of the answer will be we're going to have to see how the new copyright law is adjudicated, some more Supreme Court cases, and whether Congress is going to be changing the laws. It's going to be an interesting session tomorrow, even though it's not quite what we had originally intended. It's going to end up being a debate with different ARSC members taking four different stands, looking at it from the consumer and the industries session. And some of these people are going, and from the dealers, Steve's doing the dealers' point of view. And maybe we might also be playing devil's advocate to see how can we make available single copies of things for research purposes so the guy doesn't have to spend plane fare to go to New York or Washington to hear, you know, to hear a 15-minute record, which is the situation that most of us are in now, especially now with the AAA project. That now we know where the records are. the point is, you know, we have to get there by plane somehow, I guess, if we don't live on the East Coast.
Might be possible to work that out with the public broadcasting system set up with their satellite and down. It's not inconceivable.
That's part of the idea that I will be presenting tomorrow.
Sorry, good question.
No, you're not stepping on my feet at all. I'm glad to hear the idea coming from another.
You put it in the digits and they send it on the phone.
Yeah, no, that is a good suggestion, as a matter of fact. But the point is, this is the legal situation, because once it goes up there, you have no control over whether you are a point-to-point surface anymore because of the proliferation of backyard dishes. Yes, that's right. Barry Goldwater has just put in a bill which will open up everything. He feels if it is above his land, any signal that they send down to his land, he can receive, trying to negate Section 306 of the Communications Act. That same analogy is saying that you're legally able to eavesdrop on people's telephone calls that are going up and down by satellite. If you're using a wireless telephone, you should know that your friendly neighborhood ham may be able to hear you. The signals do travel more than a couple of hundred feet, and they have been known to do even skip and will end up 1,000 miles away. So you're be careful what you say on a wireless telephone. Yeah. It is 5:06. Bill Shirk said that he would be arriving back here somewhere in the vicinity of 5:15 from the airport. There is a map. Let me mention here. I do have, before I go into this, another announcement. Jerry Gibson wants to remind everybody that he has this wish list of things. If you want to have him look that up in the AAA and the Rigler Deutsch Index, please see Jerry and fill out your requests for some information. There is a map here which shows how to get to the library. And I guess what we might do is try to congregate sort of by the front so that those, you know, with cars, if unless the ARSC van is going to be able to take people. Why don't we say at 5:15, everybody who wants to go on a tour of the Popular Culture Archives at the Bowling Green Library, meet over in the front lobby section. No, it will be back here. After that, we will be back here, and you know, what it really is you know, a chance for you to go and eat and have something at the bar. It is just that the room will be available for people to congregate in.